Okay. Yeah?
Yeah.
Ready?
Let's go.
So, let's begin. So this is the first, let's say, iteration or test of a book I love, which will hopefully turn into a series. And sitting next to me are Helen Thomas from Women Writing Architecture, Alicia Yerebakan, from GTA Exhibitions, who is also aka Madam ETH, which is the kiosk we've now set up as a bookshop in the exhibition space of GTA Exhibitions. We're joined by Emily Apercé, who is also part of the team of Women Writing Architecture, and Adam Caruso. So today we're going to look at a book that Helen has brought with us called The Living Mountain by Nan Shepherd, which was, I believe, written in the 1940s and published, I think, only 30 years later in the 70s, which maybe we'll get to later on. And before we get into that, I'm just going to describe shortly where we are. So we're in one of the exhibition spaces of GTA Exhibitions. We can see the kiosk with all the books and their annotations, which perhaps you can get into a little bit later on. Sitting in midst the installation of Cabin Crew, which is a project by Queer Format. And yes, I think that's all for the introduction. We've got a little table in front of us, which with artifacts placed on it, which perhaps you can describe after Helen, connected to the book for you in some way. Maybe we can start off by, if you could talk a little bit more about Women Writing Architecture and how this event came about as
okay,
well.
Okay, sure. When we heard about Madame ETH and her kiosk, and also we were invited by the GTA exhibition team, Freddie and Niels, to contribute to Madame ETH's kiosk by choosing a selection of books. And we were a little bit stumped because, you know, Women Writing Architecture is a really, really long list of books which we've been inviting people to contribute to really over the last year. So we were going, which five books can we possibly choose from this, you know, list of 1,000 books? And then we decided that what we would do is we'd choose the books that were most valuable to us. And by that we mean books that the most people have said that that book is important to them. Well, actually we invite people to send in ideas for all sorts of texts, poems, even films, that as long as the author is a woman or identifies as a woman. So we ended up choosing five books. And then we thought, but really the presence of women writing architecture, we'd like it to be not just the books, but to make some ephemeral presence. So Emily, who's here today, made some beautiful bookmarks, which included information about the books that we'd chosen with the annotations written by different people. To try and encourage visitors to the bookshop, visitors to Madame ETH, to also write their thoughts on the books. So in a way, this event today is a little bit about has been started to really encourage more people to feel welcome and invited to tell us their opinions about books. So we're starting off by me telling you my opinion about a book in a hope to sort of be encouraging. I've brought a book with me, which isn't on our list yet, so we're going to happily add it on. And as Geraldine said, it's The Living Mountain by Nan Shepherd. And actually, Alicia is much more knowledgeable than me about the background of this book. She's done some amazing research, so hopefully we'll hear a little bit more of her voice later. But I chose it really just because I love the writing, I love the book, and I love the Cairngorms. And I say that with some trepidation because although I've been there, I've never actually walked for the 12 to 14 hours that's required to get onto the plateau that Nan Shepherd talks about a lot in the book. We've just kind of walked around the foothills of the Cairngorms and looked admiringly at the plateau, which is very, very beautiful. So the Cairngorms are in Scotland. They're in the heart of Scotland, in the Highlands, and they're quite an interesting place in that the Queen has her Scottish castle there, Balmoral, which was actually built by Queen Victoria in the 19th century. And Hazel and Vert have got a very fancy hotel there that you can, if you know, you can drop in for a cocktail after you've been for a walk in the Cairngorms. And there are various large estates and wealthy people and crofters and a huge diversity of people living around the mountain. I think probably in some way similar to the time that Nan Shepherd talks about at the beginning of the 20th century, but also very different. But I'm going to hand over back now to Geraldine, who is chairing the session, and I think she's going to ask some questions.
By curiosity, then, can you say, how did you discover the book?
How did I discover it? I don't know. And I wasn't a recommendation by a body. I came across it somehow. But I love it because I love the writing. And it's a book that, I don't know, I mean, maybe I could hear a bit from you guys. But there are some books that I give as gifts to my friends because they're very, very meaningful to me. And this isn't the first book of that type. The first book of that type that I have is Leonora Carrington's The Listening Trumpet, because I really love the way she celebrates old ladies and she makes this utopia, well, dystopia for them. But it's just so fascinating. I love the drawings in it, which are actually made by her son. So that's something that I started to give to friends. So I thought maybe they could join me in an old lady dystopia in the future. But I think some of them were a bit bemused and they didn't really know why I'd given it to them. And then this book about mountains, I don't know, that's more recent, my kind of obsession with it. But maybe it is to do with becoming more connected to Switzerland and thinking about the mountainous land of Switzerland and how different it is to Scotland, but then also how similar it is. And maybe that's also something that we'll touch upon together later. The reason I love it is because it's a book that I feel I can share with friends. It's very emotional, the book, and very physical. And so it's something that you kind of, it's a bit like a friendship that you share.
I think what would be really nice actually is if we could hear a short passage of the book, just so we can hear the language and then we can kind of go into the themes, a couple of themes.
That's a good idea. I was thinking if I was going to read something, I'd start with the very end, with chapter 12, which is called Being. And there are the titles of the chapters are very, very beautiful. She starts off, hold on, I'm just flicking to it now. She starts off with a chapter one is called The Plateau, which of course is the main feature of the Cairngorms. And the first six chapters are really describing the mountains and the atmosphere around them. So it's the plateau, the recesses, the group, and then water, frost and snow, air and light. And then after that, Nan Shepherd starts to talk about living things. But to me, really, her writing is most successful when she's actually describing the mountain as living. So when she talks about plants, birds and man, it becomes much more specific and less, more difficult to really connect to as an individual. But when she gets to the last three chapters, sleep, the senses and being, it again moves outwards. So being begins. Here there may be lived a life of the senses, so pure, so untouched by any mode of apprehension but their own, that the body may be said to think. Each sense heightened to its most exquisite awareness in itself total experience. This is the innocence we have lost, living in one sense of time at a time, to live all the way through. So there I lie on the plateau, Under me, the central core of fire, from which was thrust this grumbling, grinding mass of plutonic rock. Over me, blue air. And between the fire of the rock and the fire of the sun, scree, soil and water, moss, grass, flower and tree, insect, bird and beast, wind, rain and snow, the total mountain. Slowly I have found my way in. If I had other senses, there are other things I should know. It is nonsense to suppose, when I have perceived the exquisite division of running water or a flower that my separate senses can make, that there would be nothing more to perceive were we but endowed with other modes of perception. How could we imagine flavour or perfume without the senses of taste and smell? They are completely unimaginable. There must be many exciting properties of matter that we cannot know because we have no way to know them. Yet, with what we know, with what we have, what wealth! I add to it each time I go to the mountain. The eye sees what it didn't see before, or sees in a new way what it had already seen. So the ear, the other senses, it is an experience that grows, undistinguished days add their part, and now and then, unpredictable and unforgettable, come the hours when heaven and earth fall away and one sees a new creation. The many details, a stroke here, a stroke there, come for a moment into perfect focus, and one can read at last the word that has been from the beginning. And what she says at the beginning of chapter 12, I think is absolutely encapsulated, and here I turn to the table that Geraldine mentioned earlier, in the quote that is on the Scottish £5 note, her face is featured on the £5 note, the only female face in any British currency. And the quote is, "It's a grand thing to get leave to live." And I think that's just such an amazing message that of gratefulness that we're alive in this amazing world. And I really like her message of saying we have five senses through which we can perceive the world and really enjoy it. And we can perceive it over and over again and each time enjoy it in a different way. So I just find that fantastic, a fantastic thing to share with friends as well.
That's also maybe an interesting connection to also the beginning of the book, which is quite dark, actually. I think it's maybe even the foreword, where she speaks a lot about death, and which is kind of she describes who also dies on the mountain, or the danger of the mountain, and perhaps in the beginning of the book, it's very much still the mountain is quite frightening, and then when we get into the book and these very kind of the quite methodical chapters and the descriptions and the way she kind of quite almost scientifically, let's say, poetically scientifically writes about and describes this mountain, it gets you turn from kind of looking at the mountain and being frightened of the mountain to actually being in midst all this nature and really kind of on the mountain much more. I don't know if Alicia, you'd like to.
Yeah, maybe I can add some separate knowledge to that. So I was doing my research on Nan, who's actually called Anna, which I was quite surprised because it's a little silly name, I think, to call oneself Nan as an author. No, so I did some research on her, and there's not that many information about her and her life, but there was a little time after she had like a writing flow where she stopped writing and publishing, and people that were close to her, she had like this little lover which also said some things about her. She was falling into a great depression, I think, and this is, for me, when she talks about these senses, it's the sense of living that you can only have and describe so beautifully if you also acknowledge like the other side, the side of death. And for me, as I'm a painter, so that's why I really connected to the book, because there's also no white without the black color, and it's like all these contrasts in a book which is really described with a lot of like beautifulness, or like this, a lot of the words she is using are always quite beautiful. But as you said, you experience this darkness at the same time while reading those beautiful words. And it's, she's also challenging our own senses while reading the book, like the sense of the language that she uses and the sense of being or trying to live in this mountain while not being there. And like all these contrasts are in the book, how she plays with them are quite interesting, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I think what really struck me the most was this. I mean, I haven't read that many books about mountains or nature, but really kind of how much detail she really goes. And I mean, there was a couple of moments reading it when I thought, oh, this could actually become quite taxing almost, because it's kind of really just, it goes through the plants, then it goes through the water, then it goes through the birds, but it never does, because as you say, it's also very emotional or very connected to this nature, and you can very much picture what she's describing. I mean, for me, and it's funny what you said at the beginning, that for you, when she started connecting it to living things such as birds and animals, and that you kind of disconnected a little bit more. And for me, that was actually the point when I connected quite a lot.
So
yeah. So the birds was the main thing, because I'm also fascinated by birds. Actually, since the pandemic, which I've heard quite a lot as well, and I think also had to do with the fact that there were more birds where I was living because there were less planes, but also I just had more space to actually perceive these birds. And I became really fascinated by them, and that's why the whole passage, especially there's a passage on the crested tit, which I really loved, which was her kind of crouching behind the tree, waiting for these tits to kind of recognize or see her, being really still, and then flying away as soon as she moved. So, yeah.
That's so interesting. Do you want to? Maybe just about that, what I find super striking is, like, I mean, she wrote that in the 30s, and the way she gave us some tips of, like, how to experience the mountain, it's like, it's not the things of trying absolutely to reach the summit, but like being inside, you know, and like being like a dog doing rounds and trying to find the corners and things like that. And yeah, it's like for me a really contemporary way of like looking at nature, and like it's kind of this Gaia experience, or like being part of this really like of this living layers on top of the planet somehow, not being above it, so not trying to dominate, like, you know, this really iconic representation of like men being above everything. And so I was really struck by that, that she was writing that really early. And I was wondering, like, if a man would have wrote it differently at that time, and who was also, I guess at that time it was also not so popular to go hiking in the mountains. So
for British people.
It was? Yeah. Like
everyone, but it was definitely, she talks about the young railway workers, but I mean the British came to Switzerland, that's how the mountains were discovered in Switzerland.
But it was also the time of beginning of environmentalism, wasn't it? I'm not an expert, but like the Sierra Club in the States is almost exactly contemporary, and it was also about opening people's eyes to the, you know, magnificence of the landscape, but also the fragility, like all the systems of it. And I mean, like Ansel Adams, he didn't just photograph things from the top of mountains. Like he did try to evoke the embracing environment that, for instance, Yosemite and those incredible sites which became symbols for a conservation movement had.
I mean, I think that's also quite extraordinary that she manages to do that in her writing, that the nature really becomes the protagonist, because she's writing, but still the narrator is in the background, and to actually write in such a way that the nature becomes the protagonist is quite extraordinary, and not that easy, I imagine, as well, that the perspective really shifts.
I mean, when you say that, it immediately comes into my mind Jack London. You know, he's a male version of somebody writing, deeply writing about nature, but it is completely different. It's although the themes of respect for nature that you mentioned, Emily, in Nangolden are present. It's still very much a man's imagination, imagining what it's like to be a dog. You know, I'm thinking, what's it called? The one about the dog. Anyway, a fantastic book that begins with Wolves in the Forest. I mean, it's so powerful. What is it? Yeah, anyway. Adam's looking it up. We'll tell you later. but I think, Emily, I think your point's really interesting. And I've often wondered about that. You know, is it a female vision of... Because, I mean, also, I think for me, it's a metaphor for how to lead your life as well, which is another... You know, you don't have to reach for the summit, but there's great depth in circling and looking in the recesses. White Fang. I was thinking White Fang, but I thought, oh, that's too corny. I mean, but it's not the same. He's not describing it in such a scientific way. But yeah, I think that point's really interesting. But what you were saying also, what both of you were saying, made me think about the kinds of knowledge that she's. The way she's gathering and then describing knowledge. And I think there's something that's always, I don't know, maybe it's German, but the idea of being scientific, you know, because, you know, the British are very well known for being empirical, and it's an incredibly empirical book. It's about gathering knowledge through observation and living the living experience. And I guess maybe, you know, and the empirical is deeply poetic in the first half of the book to me, but then when she starts to... Even though she talks about specific incidents, it starts to become more about naming and a bit more about classifications and more scientific. And I don't know. I mean, we're both British, so I'm not accusing you of being scientific, but I don't know. I don't know. That for me is like a moment of change.
Yeah. Maybe just a small comment, a passage about reaching the summit. It's like when she described when you go hiking in group, and it's what I link to maybe my experience. You really quickly see the personality of each person of the group. So they are the ones that runs really quickly, and then after 1 hour they are exhausted. This kind of small competition here in a group of five, you can really see who is doing what.
I mean, this maybe also goes a little bit more into the specifics also of kind of, it connects to what you're saying, because if I think about the Swiss mountains and who is on the Swiss mountains, for me, and this is very stereotypical, I know, and, you know, of course there's differences, but for me, the Swiss mountaineers are very much kind of get to your goal, very kitted out, very goal-oriented, and as fast as you can, and then the summit is kind of the thing. And we were talking yesterday a little bit when we met to prepare a little bit for today about how different the experience of the mountains can be. And you were talking about your experience in Turkey you had recently. Perhaps you could talk a little bit about that again, because that was really nice.
I just want to pick up on the subject before about, because for me this was quite important in this book. For me it's not only the difference about maybe how a man would have written this book or a woman, but this kind of childish or like childly experience. How she, for me, she writes as if she still were a child in the mountain, because when you're a child, you look at everything and everything can be fascinating. If it's a minute or if it's like for an hour, you make the decision as a child yourself how long you're fascinated by something. And it's this moment where she describes where she goes down with her head and looks through the legs. And who does that as an adult? But do you all remember as a child, you used to do that. And for me, it was funny because I think it was 2 or 3 years ago where I exactly painted a woman in this position. So it picked up in the book, and I was really, and in this painting, it was about like being an adult and in the adult world and how everything must be straight and narrow, and especially like in Switzerland, or like, as you said, like hiking in Switzerland, how it can be different, especially like now I can connect to hiking in Turkey. Nobody, like hiking is not really a thing. People are quite lazy, or lazy in the sporty sense, I guess. Like Turkish people don't really enjoy sports. They do enjoy nature, and they're like quite active, like they're on the boats and stuff, especially they like being on the water, but then they're not really like hikers. So when they go hiking or decide to go, actually they hike for a little bit, but then they like sitting somewhere and then enjoying and like drinking and eating something, not going up the hill. Nobody's really interested about that. They're only interested if they maybe someone is taking them up like a taxi or something, and then they can look down on the sea. So that's what I think is a big difference, as you mentioned. Yeah.
Can I just say something about the hikers? I mean, for sure, Swiss hikers are all kitted out, but so are people in Scotland now. But I think, I mean, I don't know totally, but the land in the Cairngorms, a lot of it is, a lot of it are part of enormous estates. And in those days and today, Scotland is owned by a tiny number of people who own a huge amount of land. Nonetheless, in Scotland, there's a well-established, especially with the devolved government, right to roam. So a large percentage of the land is available to walk on, like in Switzerland, which is different than England. I wasn't going to bring England into it. To me, so the people who maintained and even formed the land in Scotland were usually people who worked for the lairds, who worked for these rich people. In Switzerland, what always strikes me is how it, you know, you could say that the origins of cooperatives and of socialism is in the high valleys and in the mountains, where small villages had to work together in order to look after the animals, in order to grow the special potatoes, et cetera, et cetera. And you have these different types of land around the villages, in the village, above the village, which are still owned and governed in that way. So it's a very different politics to the land. And the people, and many more people are involved with looking after the land in Switzerland, because there's a subsidy system, which means that farmers can more than just survive. They can do rather well being farmers, because for a couple of reasons. I think because the mountains are so much part of the national identity in Switzerland, but also because people acknowledge that it's the farmers who make the landscape, the tourists, and whether they're Swiss tourists or foreign tourists, enjoy. And that requires a huge amount of maintenance, as it does in Scotland. But in Scotland, a lot of the maintenance now is for rich people who go shooting grouse, which is, you know, and I've been on planes where people are discussing their grouse shooting weekend coming up, and it's hard to keep your food down, you know. It's, you can't believe what you're hearing. And yeah, so just, you know, the Gore-Tex and everything, yes, but actually I see like a kind of social project in the mountains in Switzerland, which is very different, where in Scotland it was really part of the whole establishment politically.
Yeah, I mean, I actually worked on an Alp once, a whole summer. And it was a very small Alp. And I think probably that type of Alp, I mean, that can only be sustained, as you say, because of the because of subsidies and politics. Because there's no, I mean, they make maybe, I don't know, 100 cheeses a year or something. It's nothing. So it's all subsidized, exactly. And I volunteered, so it's all also works with volunteers, and yeah, and I guess a lot of it is also military still, who work on paths and so on. Yeah, we wanted to get a little bit into how the book is also connected to architecture. Would you like to?
I mean, it's a really difficult question because, I mean, and I think it's actually connects to our mission in women writing architecture, in which all three of the terms women writing in architecture are the boundaries of them is being explored and tested and questioned. So, you know, women is definitely a concept which is being stretched now in a very interesting way. Writing too. In a much more basic way, we're saying, you know, let's explore what writing is, and then so architecture. I think, but just by bringing this female imagination to the subject, starts to stretch out what it can be. And I think we've already touched upon quite a few points now that in this expanded way connects to how the way we could define architecture. And I guess maybe one of the easiest ways in is something that Adam mentioned earlier about when he was talking about the Sierra Club, which is about custodianship. So this notion that we don't own things, but we are custodians for the future. So we have a responsibility to care for something and to make sure that it can persist and be perpetual. I mean, not that anything can be perpetual, but, you know, I mean, it's really a massive question now with climate change. You know, how we are responsible for our world now and our world in the future. So I think, while that's not, you know, explicit necessarily in her book, the care she takes to live and dwell in this place, and she does talk about how it changes. I think that's an issue that is architectural. But then also, I guess, on a much more simple level, there's the idea of how you understand the place of architecture, you know, a site of architecture, you know, that it's not just somewhere that can be measured in terms of monetary value or amenity value for humans, but it actually a place has a much more subtle quality that's valuable. So it kind of, she questions the notion of value, I think, or brings that question into our imaginations. You know, what is valuable? And I think that's something that architecture always responds to. And I think there's some very, very interesting questions, I mean, in this school of architecture, about what is valuable and what is beautiful that are being asked now. And I think that she really frames some ways of thinking about that are very helpful.
Yeah, I mean, I guess what you were also saying before, Emily, which is kind of as the book is, kind of, let's say, non-anthropocentric, so the human is not in the centre of this book, it is also non-architectural in a sense, because architecture is also revolves humans. Around humans, or let's say, ideas. Conventional idea of architecture.
And
exactly.
Cities as well.
Yeah.
And this is not... Yeah, we think of architecture as being in cities, don't we? Or
but
we used to.
Being challenged now, no? I mean, this idea of cohabitation, you know, it's that cities are actually very successful habitats for a lot of animals, much more so than, and wild animals are attracted to cities because of the abundance of food and shelter, etc., and maybe also the absence of competitors. But compared to a lot of books on women writing architecture, to me, the way this book is so explicitly environmental and spatial and descriptive, you know, there are other books that I think are much more difficult to locate within a frame of architecture or spatial practice and the relationship of society and spatial practice, because in this book it's absolutely explicit. And what you were saying also, it's about decentering humans, so that also seems very, very relevant now. But if you just, you know, if you looked at what the studios in the school are doing, you know, many of the studios, half I would say, are really questioning what architecture is, because we're in a moment of transition, crisis, all of these things. So it's not a hard sell, I think, in terms of this book being very within a kind of discourse of architecture.
I mean, she also acknowledges actually the importance of, because in one of the chapters, I think it's towards the end, she talks about the gamekeepers and their importance also of regulating certain, so I think it's deer and stags, and who would otherwise take over and illness would spread and so forth. So there is, it's not also completely, it does come in, yeah. Mm. We're kind of already, we've got 40 minutes already, but I don't know if someone would still like to say something or has a question.
I just wanted to say that I was really glad to have read this book, and I surely will read it again and again. I think it's a book which you can read over and over and pick out some little detail. So yeah, thank you, Helen, very much for bringing the book, and it's now also in the Madame ETH shop.
A special prize.
Yeah, so go and get the book by Nan Shepherd at Madame ETH, I guess.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone.